and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, May 18th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Flying the Coop. Nonprofit rescues hens, birds flown from Fort Dodge to sanctuary in California. Saturday morning was the first time a group of 1,000 hens were exposed to sunlight, according to Hannah Beans, animal care director for Animal Place. It's the first time they have seen the sun or touched the grass, Beans said, at the Fort Dodge Regional Airport after setting down a plastic crate containing some of the birds. It's very exciting for them. The hens had been at a farm near Fort Dodge. There, the hens were kept in a fully enclosed barn with no windows. Because of the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, that particular farm had to scale back its operations, according to Beans. That's where Animal Place came in. The nonprofit Farm Animal Sanctuary is going to care for the birds and adopt them out. We are grateful the farmer let us do this, said Beans, who drove 30 hours from California to Iowa to help coordinate the rescue with 8 local volunteers. The farm owner wished to remain anonymous. Before the care can begin, the birds needed to be transported back to the sanctuary in Grass Valley, California. On Saturday, members of Animal Care picked up the birds from the farm at about 4 a.m. After that, they drove them to the Fort Dodge Regional Airport and prepared them for the flights. The flights were to last about 7 to 8 hours, according to Gary Smith, a public relations specialist for Evolutus, representing Animal Place. And that does not include a stop to refuel, he said. The hens were held in blue and white plastic crates. Each one held 8 hens. Allison Stone and her daughter, Issy Stone, were 2 of the helpers. They traveled from Hercules' Haven in Springville to help send the animals off. I don't think any of us anticipated how labor-intensive this would be, Allison Stone said, as she breathed through an N95 mask. The hens were loaded onto 2 Metroliner aircraft. So what about all the droppings during the flight? They lined the airplanes with plastic, said Andrew Manier, who owns an animal sanctuary in Carlisle. Bean said the hens won't be ready for adoption for some time. The first few weeks is intensive care, getting them used to being out of a cage, Bean said. She said oftentimes birds will have broken wings or legs that need to heal. They require a lot of care to get them healthy before they are adopted out, Bean said. Any hens who are too ill to be adopted will remain at the sanctuary and receive lifelong care, she said. The aircraft was to land at Truckee Tahoe Airport outside of Reno, Nevada. The hens were then to be driven 1.5 hours to the sanctuary in Grass Valley. Uppadal Passion, new leadership needed. Democratic candidate seeks to replace Bean in state Senate. Editor's note. In the latest of a series of ongoing articles introducing candidates on the June 2nd primary election ballot, Cynthia Uppadal Passion of Ames, a candidate for the Democratic nomination in State Senate District 24, answers questions posed by the Messenger. Senate District 24 includes Boone, Greene, and Hamilton counties, Southeast Webster County, and Northwest Story County. The incumbent, State Senator Jerry Bean, a Republican from Boone, is retiring. Cynthia Uppadal Passion faces Keith Punteny for the Democratic nomination. The Republican contenders are Chad Bean, Joshua Dyer, Jesse Green, and Todd Rasmussen. Here are Uppadal Passion's responses. Question: What is your previous political experience? Answer: I have worked on campaigns since I was in high school. I got started making phone calls for Tom Harkin's campaign for Congress in 1976. In college, I founded Students for John B. Anderson at ISU. He ran as an independent candidate for president in 1980. Most recently, I helped my husband run for Congress in 2018. Question: What is your profession? Answer: Since 1998, I have been a volunteer with Mary Greeley Hospice. Before becoming a full-time volunteer, I worked in journalism, community organizing, and fundraising. Question: What is your educational background? Answer: I graduated from Iowa State University in Ames with a degree in journalism and mass communications. Question: Why should the voters pick you? Answer: To bring a new voice for rural Iowa. Question: In your opinion, what is the number one issue facing the state, and what would you seek to do about it if elected? Answer: Our state is without leadership, and during our time of crisis, we need new leaders who are unafraid of new ideas. First and foremost, we need to ensure that Iowans have access to health care. Our rural hospitals will need serious help to survive, and too many Iowans don't have access to quality health care and mental health care. Question: what would you recommend to rejuvenate the economy? Answer: rather than focusing on huge tax breaks for corporations who may ultimately leave the state, we ought to focus on small businesses, small farms, innovative tech, and public education. Most decisions to relocate in Iowa are influenced by our quality schools. We need to adequately fund public education to continue to draw families and businesses. Question: what would you do to bring jobs to rural Iowa? Answer: if we are going to bring jobs to rural Iowa, we must think creatively about making rural Iowa a desirable place to live and work. This can happen at the local level with community-based projects funding the arts, great public schools, access to clean water, and outdoor recreation, access to locally grown food, and quality health care. Question: what changes in the healthcare system, if any, would you recommend in response to the coronavirus pandemic? Answer: changes in the public healthcare system ought to be driven by public health providers, not politicians. Shining a light on hospital workers. Editor's note: in honor of National Hospital Week, The Messenger is delighted to feature 7 people who work at our local hospital, Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center. One person will be featured a day over the course of 7 issues of The Messenger. Each one of these people hold important positions at the hospital that may not always be recognized. We hope you enjoy getting to know them. Name: Jackie Baker. Hometown: Fort Dodge. What's your job at Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center? I work in supply chain and my title is inventory analyst. My primary duty is using an ERP system to manage our supply inventory. I am responsible for maintaining supply levels, printing barcode labels, and replenishing supply carts. I work with clinicians to provide options for non-stock supply requests, as well as receiving and inventory functions. How long have you worked at the hospital? This month starts my 15th year at TRMC. What's the toughest part about your job? Currently, the toughest part of my job is finding alternative products to substitute for manufacturer back orders and maintaining stock on hand to meet the demand. What's an interesting fact or two people might not know about you? People might not know I enjoy fishing, camping, and nature walks. How has the COVID-19 pandemic changed what you do on a daily basis? There is a heavier focus on all supplies, not just PPE. Critical supplies now require daily usage and inventory reporting. We are also working more closely with other Unity Point Health hospitals to share information and supplies when in need. We are provided daily incident command communication to keep us updated on all aspects of the pandemic. If you could have dinner with someone famous, who would it be? The best dinners are with friends and family. I don't have a choice from the famous category. What's the best part of your day? The best part of my workday is helping the supply chain team provide the necessary items for patient care departments. It benefits both the patient and caregiver if the departments have what they need when they need it. Iowa man arrested after police chase. An Iowa man is facing several charges after fleeing from police in southeast Nebraska. The Cass County Sheriff's Office says the chase reached speeds up to 130 miles per hour on U.S. Highway 75 Friday morning. The 55-year-old Council Bluffs man stopped briefly after deputies pulled him over around 11:40 a.m. before fleeing northbound. The driver's 2005 Ford Crown Victoria wound up in a ditch after he exited the highway without slowing down. The Cass County Sheriff's Office says the man was arrested on suspicion of drunken driving, fleeing to avoid arrest, reckless driving, and several other charges. Iowa health officials report 351 deaths. State health officials reported 5 more deaths and 323 additional cases of coronavirus on Sunday. The Iowa Department of Public Health said 351 people have died from COVID-19 in the state and 14,651 have tested positive for the disease caused by the coronavirus. For some infected people, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, the virus can cause severe illness or death. But for most people, it causes mild or moderate symptoms such as fever and cough that clear up in 2 to 3 weeks. News brief: community Christian to offer TK program. New for this coming 2020-21 school year is a transitional kindergarten program at Community Christian School. Along with the current kindergarten program, parents can register their child for the TK program at this time. To be eligible for kindergarten, a child must be 5 years old by September 15, 2020. CCS in Fort Dodge provides daycare for infant through elementary age children, along with before and after school care that is faith and academically based. TK through 8th grade provides a biblically integrated education. The school is state accredited and non-denominational, meaning many church denominations are represented by the students and staff. CCS offers financial assistance to those families that qualify. New family discounts and multiple family member discounts are also available. For more information and to receive a registration packet, call the school office at 515-573-3011 or email a request to ccsofficefd@gmail.com. News brief. Police contract on FD Council agenda tonight. A new one-year contract for unionized police officers is among the items on the agenda for the Fort Dodge City Council tonight. The council will meet at 6 p.m. Because of ongoing restrictions on public gatherings in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, it will be an electronic meeting. The proposed contract with Public Professional and Maintenance Employees Local 2003 would go into effect July 1st. It includes 1.5% raises on July 1st and January 1st, 2021. The promotion of a firefighter to lieutenant, some equipment purchases, and the final reading of a measure to vacate a city-owned right-of-way near Amigos, 280 North 1st Street, are also on the agenda. Road to recovery. With his community supporting him every step of the way, Williams fights back from a sudden stroke. Willie Williams remembers the feeling. Not just the raw emotion of a postseason win. That came first. As a coach, there's nothing like it. So when Fort Dodge's 28-year-old boys basketball assistant, a former Dodger player himself, was able to celebrate his team's Class 4A sub-state quarterfinal victory over Sioux City West on February 24th, he took full advantage. "I'm jumping around with all of the guys in the locker room," Williams said. "We just won our first playoff game after struggling all year. Everyone was excited, and I couldn't have been more proud." And then it hit. The energy and excitement quickly gave way to something unknown, a feeling Williams had never experienced before. "We're on the bus, and I started getting dizzy," said Williams, a 2011 Fort Dodge senior high graduate. "I couldn't see the road. I even got really hot to the point that I put my face on the window for some cold air." The most terrifying 72 hours of Williams' life, even if he didn't know it yet, had begun. When the team returned to Fort Dodge from Sioux City late that Monday night, head coach Tom Daniel and his assistants all expressed concern over Williams' well-being. "We got to the high school and all of the coaches were asking if I was okay," said Williams, a behavior interventionist at FDSH. "I kept telling them that I was fine. Looking back, I shouldn't have driven home. I remember not even being able to see the road, but I made it because it's the normal route I take. I got there and told my wife, Paige, I needed to go to the doctor. I knew something was wrong, but I threw up when I got in the car and I started feeling better after that, so I told her to turn around. We got back home and I went to bed." Williams's condition didn't improve the next day. He said his head was hurting really bad and he couldn't get everything on the same page with his movement. Eventually, he went to the emergency room. "I don't remember much from that point on," Williams said. "I was out of it the whole time. I kept reminding myself I was going to be okay. When I got life flighted to Des Moines in the helicopter, though, I could tell something was seriously wrong. The next thing I knew, I woke up and had tubes all over my body." Doctors determined Williams had suffered a right cerebellar infarct or a cerebellar stroke. They performed successful emergency surgery to relieve pressure on Williams's brain, and he spent the next 31 days at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines on the neurotrauma medical intensive care floor. "I remember waking up and seeing my wife, my mom, and my sister standing there," Williams said. "My mom lives in Memphis, so I knew if she just left everything to come all the way here, it must be bad." Thankfully, Williams is on the mend now. He's at On With Life Rehabilitation Center in Ankeny almost 3 months into his recovery. It's been hard, both physically and mentally, Williams admitted. Physically, because no one wants to be laying in bed with tubes all over them. Mentally, because I am known for being healthy and I just want to go home with my family. That day is hopefully coming soon. Williams is scheduled to return to Fort Dodge no later than May 28th. The rehab process has been both good and hard, Williams said. You have to get up every day and find the motivation to do it, but I feel myself getting better and better. I had to learn how to walk and talk all over again. So much has been impacted and changed due to my stroke. Williams is quick to add that in retrospect, I should have gone and gotten checked out. The exact cause of the stroke still isn't known, though Williams, a former standout athlete at both FDSH and Iowa Central, has dealt with high blood pressure before. Looking back, I should have listened to my wife, my mom, and my sister about going to a doctor, Williams said. But I've never really had health problems before this happened, so I just didn't take some of the warning signs serious enough. Williams is just taking things moment by moment as he prepares for the next step. He said, I'd guess I'm at about 65 to 75% of the way back to full health. I'm making progress every day, but I'm not where I need to be, Williams said. I ask myself, why me? Sometimes, but you never know the answer to that. So I just started telling myself to focus on the positive things I have going on in my life. My short-term goal is to do my best with rehab and get back to walking and talking at a normal level. On With Life has been a great place for me to recover, and Williams has been there since March 27th. Being able to hold his wife and kids soon, son Willie Jr., age 5, and daughter Piper, 8 months, is the ultimate reward and light at the end of the tunnel. Because of strict rules at rehabilitation facilities due to the global pandemic, Williams hasn't seen his children face-to-face since arriving in Ankeny almost 7 weeks ago. He's only been with Paige in person twice, 6 feet apart and wearing masks during that period of time. They mean everything to me, Williams said. As much as I've wanted to come home and they've wanted me home, they understand that I have to get better for that to happen. Due to COVID-19, I've only been able to see them through a window. That's been hard, but you have to do what you have to do. Williams credits the Fort Dodge community with the love and care to inspire him during the journey back. It's just been huge for me, Williams said. I can't tell you how many messages or phone calls I've had. It shows how many people care in this world. I have so much love for our town. It's important that I keep a positive attitude. I've come a long way thanks to my family and support system and everyone who cares about me getting better. I look at it now like, what could be worse? I've been through the storm and rain and I'm still standing. Thank God. Springer stays strong for Dad, family. Fort Dodge senior-to-be focuses on the positive in the face of life-altering changes. Sawyer Springer and his family needed a day like this. Over 150 vehicles lined the street in front of the Springer's Fort Dodge residence on Sunday. The community wanted to show its support for Sawyer's father, Steve, a 1979 St. Edmund graduate who is currently fighting esophageal cancer. The surprise parade, organized by Steve's high school classmates, friends, relatives, and co-workers, delivered the kind of memory the Springer household will cherish forever. I was sitting in the yard behind my dad with my cousins, and it meant a lot, to say the least, said Sawyer, who was finishing up his junior year at Fort Dodge Senior High when the global pandemic hit in March. He knows how many people care for him and support him in this town, but this was really the first time he got to see that in person, not just through words. I know it meant a lot to my family, too. There was family that came from Des Moines just to see my dad in the parade. My cheeks were starting to hurt because I couldn't stop smiling. A four-sport athlete at FDSH, Sawyer Springer has been a 2-year starter on the Dodgers' offensive line, the 220-pounder in Fort Dodge's third-place state wrestling lineup, and a varsity baseball and track participant. Springer's life was turned upside down 2 months ago when his dad first learned of the illness. The youngest of Steve and Julie's 3 sons has done his best to navigate a roller coaster of emotions, with school, sports, activities, and his home life all taking a sharp turn at once. It's been very hard to process, Sawyer admitted. Sometimes I stop what I'm doing and just think, is this really happening? That sounds like something out of a movie, but it's true. I think the hardest part has been seeing him physically change. I know he's the same guy deep down, but the hardest obstacle to get over is how hard it's affecting him physically. Yet he stays so strong. And I think the other toughest thing is how hard all of this has been on my mom. But I know they both are trying their hardest to stay strong, so I have to do the same. They're the best parents I could ask for. Springer has leaned heavily on family and friends to help him navigate through uncharted waters. I have to try and look on the bright side of things, said Springer, who is also Dodger Senate President, All-State and Choir, and a state speech qualifier. I'm closer to my brothers than I think I've ever been before. Almost every day, everyone in our family is home. Older brothers Shay and Sean live on their own, so that's helped keep us together. I've also been using all of this anger and sadness as motivation. Former Dodger standouts Drake Miller and Logan Finowski have both come back from Grandview, and they've been my closest friends during all of this. We've been working out 5 to 6 days a week, and I think that's been a good way to get my mind off of things. I'm glad to call them my friends. The uncertainty surrounding both the upcoming baseball and football campaigns due to COVID-19 is difficult for the student athletes, but according to Springer, patience is a must. I know a lot of people in the baseball and football programs are eager to get back to playing, but I think we all understand the circumstances, said Springer, who has been active in the school musical, fall play, water polo club, storytellers club, National Honor Society, and the Little Dodger school newspaper as well. I'd like to think most of us are buying in and preparing on our own for the upcoming seasons. Come game time, I think it'll really show who put in the work during this quarantine. Due to both the adverse circumstances and the way the community continues to rally around his family, Springer's passion and loyalty to the Fort Dodge community has never been stronger. Growing up, I always wanted to be a Dodger, Springer said. I looked up to the athletes. Now that I'm finally here and I'm about to be a senior, I can't help but notice how fast it's gone. Whenever someone asks me what I want to do when I'm older, I always tell them I don't know yet, but I want to live in Fort Dodge and keep being a part of this community. And now, time out with Sawyer Springer. Vacation destination, Prague. People I would like to have dinner with, my Grandpa Yoder, my Grandpa Springer, and Kyle Long. It would surprise people that I love to sing. Sports role model, Walter Payton, never die easy. Everyday role model, my mom and dad. I can't go a day without milk. Nickname, beans or soybeans. Superstition, I listen to the same songs right before a game. Most heated rivalry, Mason City. Favorite road trip, wrestling in Chicago last year. What are you listening to right now? Hozier. Favorite team, Chicago Bears. Favorite class, history. Favorite movie, Shawshank Redemption. Favorite book, 1984. Favorite phone app, YouTube. A new leaf. Amid mall shakeup, pandemic, personal expressions moves downtown. Amanda Pert's art and hair studio, Personal Expressions, has experienced two major setbacks since its opening in January 2019. In November 2019, Pert found out that Crossroads Mall, where her business was located, would soon have new owners. And the plans of those new owners involved tearing the mall down and replacing it with a series of smaller stores, an office building, and a hotel. Pert, a Fort Dodge senior high graduate, realized she wouldn't be able to afford rent in the new stores. And in March, Pert had to close anyways because of COVID-19 restrictions placed on salons throughout the state. I loved it at the mall, Pert said. The mall staff and employees from other stores were like family, and I'm very upset that we have to separate. When Pert's lease was up in April, she decided it was time to look for a new home for Personal Expressions. And soon after, she found it at 1214 Central Avenue in downtown Fort Dodge. She found that the building was spacious, the price was right, and the location would give her a chance at building her customer base. Personal Expressions was set to open Saturday, following Governor Kim Reynolds' announcement earlier in the week, permitting salons to reopen with certain guidelines in place. We all have to wear masks and change them after each client, Pert said. We have disinfectant everywhere. Our number one concern is people can come in here and be safe. Pert is joined by hairstylists Ashley Parks, Christina Passau, and Lynn Brown. Each stylist is their own boss and has their own clientele. We all work for ourselves, Pert said. We are essentially a group of small businesses under one business. For the past several weeks, Pert, Parks, and Passau have been without income. But Pert said the timing of the shutdown worked out okay. We got shut down in the middle of March, which actually for us was a blessing because we were in the middle of moving the salon, Pert said. But since it's been extended, we have all been out of a job for about 8 weeks. Now that it has been lifted, we have a multitude of guidelines and restrictions to follow. We have to get used to those as our new normal. In that time, the women have transformed their new space. We brought in the new stations, the mirrors, painted everything, Pert said. We brought everything from the mall with us. And Pert has given it that personal expressions feel with a tree painted on one of the walls of the shop. The tree is in progress, Pert said. I couldn't take the tree with me that I made at the mall. It's part of the drywall there. She said the tree will continue to change in the coming months. Pert hopes to offer art lessons at her new location, much like she did at the mall. I will do private art lessons, Pert said. I plan to do private art lessons once we get up and going. I want to get settled in with the salon side of stuff. I definitely have a passion for art and hope to be able to do the small classes. The stylists offer full salon services, including hair, color, and cuts. Child and senior haircuts are $14. Adult haircuts are $18. Body waxing, facials, microblading, permanent eyeliner, eyelash extensions, lift and tint, lip blushing, braiding, and ombre brows are among the other services provided. Parks of Fort Dodge said only booked appointments will be accepted for the time being. We're not accepting walk-ins, she said. When normality continues, we will accept walk-ins with no problem. Parks admits it's a challenging time to debut in a new location. Our hardest thing is we didn't really have an opening here, Parks said. We have to have a grand opening with COVID and all the restrictions. Opening in a brand new place we have never been in before. To book an appointment at Personal Expressions, call 515-574-9404. About the stylists, Amanda Pert. Pert is a Fort Dodge Senior High graduate. She has been a licensed cosmetologist for 14 years. She attended LeJames International College. The name of the business, Personal Expressions, uses the first two letters of Pert's last name, P and E. Lynn Brown. Brown is an FDSH graduate. She graduated in 2015 from Iowa School of Beauty in Sioux City. Brown, who lives in Fort Dodge, enjoys helping people look the way they want to. I really do enjoy doing hair a lot, Brown said. I like the creativity. And you can build really good relationships with the clients you have. Ashley Parks. Parks of Fort Dodge has been styling hair since 2014 after graduating from LeJames International College. I feel like I've always wanted to do hair. However, it's not the most financially suitable job for a single mom, Parks said. But when I got more financially stable, I went to school, and here we are. Parks is a former manager at Subway and Tire Lube Express at Walmart. She's a graduate of FDSH. Parks has been a stylist at Mastercuts and Cost Cutters. Christina Passau. Passau of Fort Dodge graduated from LeJames International College in August 2019. She has worked at Wells Fargo and Pancheros. Passau, a Manson Northwest Webster High School graduate, is looking forward to developing her skills at Personal Expressions. Amanda took me under her wing when I first got out of school and was mentoring me because most people don't run a chair right after school, Passau said. She's helped me build my clientele and answered my questions since I was fresh out of school. You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, May 18th, 2020 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Maynard W. Eisenberger. Maynard W. Eisenberger, 100, of Garner, died Friday, May 15th at Westview Care Center in Britt. Funeral services will be held at 1:30 p.m. on Tuesday, May 19th at Cataldo Funeral Chapel, 160 East 4th Street in Garner, with Reverend Michael Schaefer officiating. Military rites will be conducted by the Garner Veterans Ceremonial Unit. The service will be live-streamed on the Cataldo Funeral Home Facebook page and available for viewing after the service on the funeral home website, Tribute Wall. Burial will follow at Evergreen Cemetery in Clarion. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to services at the funeral chapel. Memorials may be directed to the Garner United Methodist Church. Maynard W. Eisenberger, the son of George and Minnie Eisenberger, was born November 16, 1919, in Dixon, Missouri. He grew up in Clarion, where he graduated from high school. Maynard served his country during World War II in the U.S. Army as a field lineman in Central Europe. Following his honorable discharge in 1945, he returned home to work in Clarion. On September 8, 1951, he married June May Russa in Moline, Illinois. They lived in Clarion, Carroll, Osage, Forest City, and in 1969 moved to Garner. Maynard was employed as an eggplant manager in Osage and later worked at Winnebago in Forest City until his retirement. In his retirement, he mowed lawns and tilled gardens in the Garner area for many years. He enjoyed gardening and having coffee in the morning with friends at the local grocery store. Maynard was very proud to have celebrated his 100th birthday at the Garner United Methodist Church this past November. He was a member of the Garner United Methodist Church and the Garner VFW. Maynard is survived by his stepdaughter, Janice Pitstick, and spouse Dennis of Fonda, three grandsons, Scott Pitstick and spouse Carla of Fonda, Richard Pitstick and spouse Lana of Fonda, and Randy Pitstick of Fonda, 8 great-grandchildren, and a great-grandson, Rowan Pitstick, many nieces and nephews, and special friends Nancy and Russell Norby. He was preceded in death by his parents, wife June on August 17, 1995, an infant daughter, Deanne, and many brothers and sisters. Phyllis Carsey. Phyllis R. Carsey, 87, of Fort Dodge, passed away on Saturday, May 16th at the Marion Home. Family graveside services will be held at St. James Cemetery in Forest City. Serving the family is the Lauffersweiler Seavers Funeral Home. Phyllis is survived by her children, Kathy Dahlgren and her husband Dave of Clarion, Steve Carsey and his wife Bryce of Altoona, Craig Carsey and his wife Susan of Birmingham, Alabama, Martha Hager and her husband Mark of Fort Dodge, John Carsey and his wife Sandy of LaGrange, Georgia, Jeff Carsey and his wife Kathy of Williston, Florida, Laura Gobelli and her husband John of Mason City, 20 grandchildren and 24 great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her parents, Jason and Fern Roberts Burke, husband Gene in 2013, siblings Jim Burke, Mary Fellen, Dennis Burke, Doug Burke, and John Burke, and her daughter-in-law, Teresa Carsey. Phyllis R. Burke was born on March 29, 1933, near Rockford. She attended country schools near Rockford and later Doherty. She attended the 8th grade in Sheffield, and later the family moved to Hampton, where she graduated high school in 1951. Phyllis then went to AIB College in Des Moines and went to work for Maytag in Hampton and later Underwriter Adjustment Company in Mason City. In July of 1952, she met Gene Carsey on a blind date, and on January 3, 1953, the couple were married at Holy Family Catholic Church. They established their home in Mason City until the couple moved to Kansas City, Kansas. They made their home in various towns, including Mason City, Forest City, Fort Dodge, and Rockwell City. While living in Fort Dodge, Phyllis worked at Lillian's and in food service for 13 years. Phyllis was also a self-employed seamstress for 25 years. In 1999, they retired and moved to Webster City, where they attended Faith Methodist Church. Phyllis was a past member of Fort Dodge JCs, BPW, and the Rockwell City Lioness Club. Memorials may be left to the direction of the family. Ramona Sue Wines. Ramona Sue Wines, 77, of Fort Dodge, died on Friday, May 15th, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home in Fort Dodge. A service will be held at a later date. Arrangements have been entrusted to Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Ramona Sue Wines, the daughter of Meredith and Marion Cozier Morrow, was born on October 9, 1942, in Cherokee. She graduated from Cherokee High School in 1961. Ramona was a successful realtor for RE/MAX for many years. She was a member of the Fort Dodge Chamber of Commerce Board for 6 years, and she served as chamber president in 2001. In 2003, Ramona was honored with the Athena Award from the Fort Dodge Chamber of Commerce. Ramona also served on the Friendship Haven Board, the Trinity United Methodist Church Finance Committee, and the Foundation and Hospice Boards and the Community Action Network Board for Trinity Regional Hospital. She was also an active member of the Kiwanis Club, as well as many other city and neighborhood betterment groups. She was also involved in many local and state political campaigns. Ramona loved the community of Fort Dodge and worked in service of the community her whole adult life. Ramona is survived by her daughters, Rhonda Wines and partner Fred Sinkovich of Des Moines, and Roxanne Wines and partner Ryan Kleinsmith of Coralville, her granddaughter Haley, and her siblings Darlene Badrick of Portland, Oregon, Orville Morrow and his spouse Ruth of Sioux City, and Dan Morrow and spouse Pam of Cherokee. Ramona was preceded in death by her parents, Meredith and Marion, her brother, Mike Morrow, and her sister, Karen Udish. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Trinity United Methodist Church, Iowa Public Television, or St. Jude's Children's Hospital. Donna Lee Moe. Donna Lee Moe, 93, of Moreland, died May 16th at the Marion Home. Private family services will be held at Fulton Lutheran Church with burial in Fulton Lutheran Cemetery. Gunderson Funeral Home is entrusted with the arrangements. Donna Lang, daughter of Anthony and Elizabeth Grimes Lang, was born May 31st, 1926 in Rockwell City. She graduated from Manson High School and then taught country school on the normal training certificate. She was united in marriage to Howard Moe on December 7th, 1946. The couple made their home on a farm near Moreland. Following Howard's retirement, the couple spent their summers at Twin Lakes and winters in McAllen, Texas. In retirement, she enjoyed taking bus trips. Howard preceded her in death in 1997. Donna was a resident at the Marion Home since December 2014. Donna was a member of Fulton Lutheran Church and WELCA, former 4-H leader, Moreland Book Club, local bridge clubs, former Trinity Regional Medical Center Auxiliary Board, and volunteer for many years. Survivors include her children, Sandra Johnson and spouse John of Fremont, Nebraska, Greg Moe and spouse Karen, and Kevin Moe and spouse Kathy, all of Moreland, grandchildren, Sarah Acterlone, Mary Drew, Jason Moe, Ryan Moe, Brandon Moe, and Joshua Moe, sister Zeta Gadbury, and brother Ron Lang and spouse Iva. She was preceded in death by her husband Howard, her parents, and her brother Jack Lang. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family, sent to P.O. Box 138, Moreland, Iowa, 50566. Billy Williams. Billy L. Williams, Jr., 55, of Fort Dodge, passed away Friday, May 15th, after a courageous battle with cancer. A memorial service will be at a later date. Loffersweiler Seaver's Funeral Home is serving the family. He is survived by his wife, LaVon Niemand, daughter, Christy Niemand, and son, Hunter Niemand. He is also survived by his mother, Donna Red Nichols of Fort Dodge, siblings Patricia Froley and spouse Roger of Ankeny, Robert Williams, Terry Williams, Jason Nichols and spouse Tricia, Kevin Nichols and spouse Allison, all of Fort Dodge, and Brian Nichols and spouse Nicole of Johnston, many nieces and nephews, and the Neiman family. He was preceded in death by his father, Billy Williams Sr., sister Christine Renee Nichols, and stepfather Francis Doty Nichols. Billy Louise Williams, Jr. was born June 3, 1964, in Spirit Lake. He graduated from Fort Dodge Senior High School. After graduation, he attended an HVAC trade school. He later attended Iowa Central Community College and received his culinary arts and truck transportation degrees. Billy loved the Iowa Hawkeyes and Chicago Cubs. He enjoyed NASCAR and being outdoors hunting and fishing. Before retiring due to his illness, Billy worked as a stage technician. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Roger Lenning. Roger A. Lenning, 78, of Humboldt, passed away on Saturday, May 16th, at Iowa Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines. He is survived by his wife, Nancy, children Chris Lenning of Fort Dodge and daughter Andrea George and spouse Sean of Humboldt, grandchildren Keaton Lenning, Caleb Lenning, Addison Lenning, Zachary George and Haley George, and brother Doug Lenning and spouse Jan of Dakota City. He was preceded in death by his parents, sister Sherry Cubley, and sister-in-law Patricia Lenning. Funeral services will be held on Thursday, May 21st at 11 a.m. at the Mason Lindhart Funeral and Cremation Service. A visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the start of the funeral service at the funeral home. Carol B. Shimon. Carol B. Shimon, age 84, of Pocahontas, passed away on Thursday, May 14th at the Pocahontas Manor Care Center in Pocahontas. Private family funeral services will be held on Tuesday, May 19th at the Powers Funeral Home in Pocahontas with Monsignor Michael Cernett officiating. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery in Pocahontas. There will be no visitation. Powers Funeral Home in Pocahontas is handling arrangements. For online condolences and obituary, visit powersfh.net. Editorial. Spirit of the Greatest Generation Needed to Defeat COVID-19. Americans should look to example of those who won World War II. During 3.5 years, Americans converted a peacetime economy to become the arsenal of democracy and win World War II. The Greatest Generation accomplished that because it had to be done for the good of all humankind. Now we as a nation face another challenge of far less magnitude, and some Americans, including a few to whom we look for both political and scientific leadership, have already declared defeat. The war against COVID-19 is not an existential struggle, but millions of lives are at stake, and not just from the coronavirus. Suspensions of manufacturing and other economic activity have occurred throughout the world as a result of the pandemic. Unless we reopen expeditiously, a global depression may occur. It could be as deadly as the disease itself. One key to getting our economies back in action is increasing access to tests for COVID-19, both to identify people who have the virus and those who have recovered from it. U.S. taxpayers already have put up $2.5 billion to fund a public-private partnership to develop new testing technology and manufacture kits. Last week, National Institutes of Health Director Francis Collins expressed doubt the task can be completed by the end of the summer. "I must tell you," he told a group of U.S. senators, "that this is a stretch goal that goes well beyond what most experts think will be possible. The scientific and logistical challenges are truly daunting." They are. To dispute that would be childishly unrealistic. But to begin the campaign by waving a white flag would be both dangerous and, well, un-American. Giving up is not what we as a nation do. In 1941, Americans mobilized for World War II in a spirit of angry patriotism. At the same time, a quiet, determined realism took hold. Government set goals for development of new technologies and manufacture of both war materials and other needs such as food and medicine. Then government worked with the private sector to eliminate obstacles, many of them inherent to the bureaucracy, it must be noted. Finally, Americans rolled up their sleeves and went to work. And they did it. Are we today made of the same stuff? A letter to the editor. Ball organizers say thank you. To the editor. We're all in. The theme of the 37th Friends of St. Edmund Ball was exemplified on so many levels and in so many ways these past few weeks. A journey that began late last year with the primary challenge of following a record-breaking year for funds raised quickly changed course in March as the COVID-19 global pandemic began to take hold in our country and state. We were faced with the harsh reality that the traditional SE ball that has been penciled in on the first weekend in May for the last 36 years would not take place. Despite this devastating setback, the choice was made to double down. This year's event became a no-show ball, and the live and silent auctions were moved to an online auction. We were concerned about asking our friends, neighbors, and businesses for support as the uncertainty of this coronavirus took its toll on our economy. We are proud to say that our community responded in a big way, exemplifying our theme, "We're All In." We are extremely grateful to the many individuals and organizations that contributed to another successful SE ball. First and foremost, thank you to everyone that made a special gift, bought a ticket, purchased raffle tickets, donated to our auction, placed a bid, or joined our live social media event. St. Edmund is incredibly blessed, and we are extremely humbled by your generosity. Thank you to anyone that volunteered your time to make a phone call, share a post on social media, or promote the no-show ball in any way. Many thanks to Tom Micklow and Mary Lynn Biggins for guiding us in the right direction and supporting us along the way, as well as Travis Patterson for his technology support in taking our event online. Special thanks to Monsignor McCoy, Father Feller, and SC President Mary Gibb for their contributions to our live no-show ball broadcast. As co-chairs, we are beyond thrilled to share that the 37th Friends of St. Edmund No-Show Ball has raised net proceeds in excess of $250,000. Even though we could not be together in person, the St. Edmund community has risen to the challenge once again. We're all in. Signed, Craig and Jamie Schlenz. U.S. European leaders weigh reopening risks without a vaccine. Some world leaders say vaccine could be years away. On a weekend when many pandemic-weary people emerged from weeks of lockdown, leaders in the U.S. and Europe weighed the risks and rewards of lifting COVID-19 restrictions, knowing that a vaccine could take years to develop. In separate stark warnings, two major European leaders bluntly told their citizens that the world needs to adapt to living with the coronavirus and cannot wait to be saved by a vaccine. We are confronting this risk, and we need to accept it, otherwise we would never be able to relaunch, Italian Premier Giuseppe Conte said, acceding to a push by regional leaders to allow restaurants, bars, and beach facilities to open Monday, weeks ahead of an earlier timetable. The warnings from Conte and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson came as governments worldwide and many U.S. states struggled with restarting economies blindsided by the pandemic. With 36 million newly unemployed in the U.S. alone, economic pressures are building, even as authorities acknowledge that reopening risks setting off new waves of infections and deaths. In the U.S., images of crowded bars, beaches, and boardwalks suggested some weren't heeding warnings to safely enjoy reopened spaces while limiting the risks of spreading infection. Britain's Johnson, who was hospitalized last month with a serious bout of COVID-19, speculated Sunday that a vaccine may not be developed at all, despite the huge global effort to produce one. There remains a very long way to go, and I must be frank that a vaccine might not come to fruition, Johnson wrote in the Mail on Sunday newspaper. President Donald Trump, by contrast, promised Americans a speedy return to normalcy that sounded far more optimistic than most experts say is realistic. We're looking at vaccines, we're looking at cures, and we are very, very far down the line, he said, while calling into a charity golf tournament broadcast on NBC. I think that's not going to be in the very distant future, but even before that, I think we'll be back to normal. Trump said events would likely resume with small crowds, if any, but hopes that by the time the Masters tournament is played in November, the crowds can return. Health experts, however, say the world could be months, if not years, away from having a vaccine available to everyone, and they have warned that easing restrictions too quickly could cause the virus to rebound. The coronavirus has infected over 4.6 million people and killed more than 314,000 worldwide, according to a tally by Johns Hopkins University that experts say undercounts the true toll of the pandemic. The U.S. has reported over 89,000 dead, and Europe has seen at least 160,000 deaths. For most people, the coronavirus causes mild or moderate symptoms. For some, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illness and lead to death. Some experts noted recent infection surges in Texas, including a 1,800 case jump Saturday, with Amarillo identified as a growing hotspot. Texas officials said increased testing was playing a big role. The more you look for something, the more you find it. Many are watching hospitalizations and death rates in the weeks ahead to see exactly what the new Texas numbers really mean. But Texas was one of the earliest states to allow stores and restaurants to reopen, and Dr. Michael Sag at the University of Alabama in Birmingham called Texas a warning shot for states to closely watch any surges in cases and have plans to swiftly take steps to stop them. No one knows for sure exactly the right way forward, and what I think we're witnessing is a giant national experiment, said SAG, an infectious diseases researcher. In the U.S., many states have lifted stay-at-home orders and other restrictions, allowing some types of businesses to reopen. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, a Republican, told CNN on Sunday that he was concerned to see images of a crowded bar in Columbus on the first day that outdoor dining establishments were allowed to reopen. We made the decision to start opening up Ohio, and about 90% of our economy is back open because we thought it was a huge risk not to open, he said. But we also know it's a huge risk in opening. An editorial by Rich Lowry. Fauci is not the villain. For his critics, Dr. Anthony Fauci cemented his status as the Rasputin of public health with his Senate testimony the other day. The National Institutes of Health official gently but unmistakably struck a different tone than President Donald Trump, earning rebukes from radio talk show hosts and Fox News anchors, as well as fueling the outrage of the hashtag FireFauci claque on Twitter. Although Fauci's every utterance is now examined with the same care as pronouncements of the Pope, his words weren't exactly earth-shattering. He said that if there are careless reopenings, we will start to see little spikes that might turn into outbreaks. Does anyone doubt that's a possibility? No serious person would argue that there are no hazards to reopening, only that some level of risk is worth taking to begin to ease the nation's economic calamity. Fauci is an important voice in this debate, if only one voice. He is neither the dastardly bureaucratic mastermind imposing his will on the country that his detractors on the right make him out to be, or the philosopher king in waiting that his boosters on the left inflate him into. He's simply an epidemiologist, one who brings considerable expertise and experience to the table, but at the end of the day, his focus is inevitably and rightly quite narrow. This is why it's a tautology for Fauci's critics to say that he's focused on the disease above all else. This is like saying the Commerce Secretary is too consumed with finding business opportunities for American companies, or the head of the Joint Special Operations Command has an unhealthy obsession with killing terrorists. What else are they supposed to do? As a breed, epidemiologists tend to focus on the worst case. They don't want to be wrong and contribute to some deadly pathogen getting loose when their entire job is to keep that from happening. So they are naturally cautious. This, too, is as it should be. You probably don't want a risk-taking epidemiologist any more than you want a highly creative and envelope-pushing accountant. For all these reasons, you wouldn't choose an epidemiologist to run your country either, and Fauci isn't. Trump has remained completely undomesticated in the White House. The idea that he has now, as some of his supporters imply, been seduced, bullied, or otherwise manipulated by a mild-mannered, nearly 80-year-old doctor is bonkers. The reason Trump issued his shutdown guidance was that the prospect of uncontrolled spread of the virus was too risky to contemplate. Since populist critics of the shutdowns don't want to criticize Trump, let alone say that they think he blew one of the most consequential decisions of his presidency, they focus their ire on the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases instead. In the attention-getting exchange between Rand Paul and Anthony Fauci at the Senate hearing, both were right. Senator Paul is obviously correct that we shouldn't elevate one person as the authority to whom everyone submits, and Fauci was right that he's a scientist who doesn't even try to give advice on matters outside his ambit. Part of the right's hostility to Fauci is an understandable reaction to progressives putting him on a pedestal. His views should be taken seriously, but they can't be determinative. The coronavirus crisis is a radically different phenomenon than, say, the Ebola outbreak, because it implicates our entire society. What relative weight to give to the economy and public health, among other weighty public policy questions, is way above Fauci's pay grade. This is what we elect presidents, governors, and mayors to decide. It's their responsibility to balance the competing considerations, and if they are found wanting, they lose their jobs. Anyone in this position will want to hear from experts, though, which is why if Trump really did fire Fauci, some other meddlesome epidemiologist would emerge soon enough. If Fauci didn't exist, we'd have to invent him. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, May 18th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.